the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Today marks the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. And it is a day that, of course, prompts us all to some memory and also some reflection on what all of this means. And, of course, the distance of 40 years is a significant distance. You're talking about a biblical span of a generation there in which many of the people who will be a part of this conversation today and listening to our conversation today will not have been alive in 1968 when this event happened. We're going to be putting it in its historical context. We're going to be trying to figure out what it means for us all. And we're going to be looking at the impact of Martin Luther King Jr. as a man. We're also going to be looking at the impact of the civil rights movement. And we're going to be asking the big question that has to be right in front of us whenever we have something like this as our issue. And that is, what does it say about how Christians should think about issues of racism, of racial diversity and all the rest in the church and in the culture today? To join the conversation, call us at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll get to that in just a moment. Let me remind you that at my website at albertmohler.com, you can find continuing updates of articles. And the article posted this morning is entitled Wombs for Rent, Newsweek Looks at Surrogate Mothers. You'll recall we talked about this on the program yesterday. We had a very interesting discussion about what's going on in the entire field of surrogate motherhood and gestational carriers, as they now prefer to be called. But even in the article, I'm able to deal with some things that we did not have time to deal with on the air, and I would refer you to this article. And from my article, you can link directly to Newsweek. But I think, just given from the mail that has been coming in, that I'm a bit surprised and how many Christians are already familiar with people who have been considering surrogacy, hiring a surrogate, getting a baby by means of surrogacy. And with all of that going on, it's just a reminder that a lot of these things can appear pretty theoretical or hypothetical until all of a sudden it lands in your home, in your church, and with someone close to you. That's the reason why, as we said yesterday, we need to think ahead to be ready to give an answer as to how we should think about these things and how we should, of course, come up with a Christian response that's intelligent, thoughtful, reasoned, biblical. Other issues in the news include the fact that a federal judge has rejected the posting of the Ten Commandments in Grayson County, Kentucky. Now, get this, arguing that the reason why the display is unconstitutional is that it had, quote, a religious purpose. Now, I love the way Peter Smith of the Courier-Journal here in Louisville, Kentucky, begins his article. The reporter has as his first line, "Thou shalt not post the Ten Commandments on public property with religion in mind." Now, this is not an opportunity for an extended conversation or consideration of the issue of what it should be considered to be rightly constitutional to post or not to post in the United States. It's a reminder to us that the United States Supreme Court has entered into the most awkward terrain. And in the last series of decisions based upon things such as the display of the Ten Commandments, instead of clarifying on the matter of some clear constitutional principle on narrowly split decisions, it decided that one display, that's the one in Texas, was legitimate, where one in Kentucky was not. And it would defy the mind of Solomon to try to figure out how to comply with the order and with the interpretation of those decisions. This is a situation that really should not be in the courts. This is just another reminder to us that courts are not institutions that are well suited to handle this kind of nuance. And so those who insist on bringing these cases to the court have to know they have an agenda to basically, eliminate. That has to be the purpose, to eliminate the kind of public display of any kind of religious conviction they find objectionable. You won't be surprised to know that the American Civil Liberties Union has been involved in this, and along with others that brought the case to the courts and have pressed it. We'll be following this because I can assure you that's not the end of the story. Meanwhile, in a similar kind of situation, this one in Switzerland, the schools there in Switzerland are beginning to complain. Teachers particularly are beginning to complain because they're being asked to teach values, but they are prohibited from teaching religion. Now, while you hear the argument coming recurringly in this country, can you be an atheist and have good morals? Can you be an atheist and have good values? Just remember that those who are actually having to teach values or to teach ethics have to teach something as ethical and something as not. And once you do that, you are involved in a worldview. You may not want to call it a religion, but you're involved in a worldview. The only way to coherently teach morality is on the basis of some kind of worldview. That's why the teachers in Switzerland are complaining. The Teachers Association there is pointing out in an official position paper that even as the state-run schools are being asked to pursue the teaching of values, being ordered to do so, they are ordered to be neutral as far as religious orientation is concerned. The paper says, and I cite, "It is impossible without certain basic values to do this, that is to teach values, which means injecting value systems which threaten these basic values." So it's really interesting. In other words, they're saying we can't do this. We can't teach values and be neutral in religion without saying that some things are right and some things are wrong, and religions differ on these things. Someone's going to say we're imposing religion when actually we're just trying to teach values. But this just comes back to a basic Christian understanding of the unity of all truth. And let's just remember this. Let's come back to a basic Christian presupposition, which is because we believe at the very starting point of our understanding, our worldview, in the existence of a sovereign God who is the source of all goodness and beauty and truth. If the good, the beautiful, and the true are one thing, then of course morality is essentially tied to larger issues that are indeed rightly labeled as religion. The association says knowledge of religion on the part of basic education is important for personal development. Without this kind of knowledge, children are cut off from their cultural roots. But the big issue here is really not the cultural knowledge of religion. It's because individual religions differ on some basic issues of morality, and you can't teach morality without at least acknowledging this. And if you're trying to come up with some kind of moral system, some moral method, some way of applying principles to situations that real-life people are going to experience, you're going to have to impose some kind of worldview as normative. So it'll be very, very interesting to see how this comes down. And this is in Switzerland, after all. This is not Grayson County, Kentucky, where the Ten Commandments story was located. This is Switzerland, but a very similar kind of dynamic going on there. I don't know if you've been following this in the news, but several of the cable news networks have been giving this a lot of attention, probably because it makes for good video, which means it certainly captures your attention. Little boys, and when I say little boys, we're really talking here about elementary school age boys, that are put into a cage with minimal protection in order to do what is now called cage fighting. Ultimate fighting has become a matter of entertainment and a pastime. For some young males, especially 20-somethings and teenagers in America, it's become pretty popular with high school and college students. And in some sense, it's kind of like testosterone gone wild. I think back to the novel Fight Club, in which the protagonist says, "This is what a generation of boys raised without fathers looks like. We have to figure out how to show our masculinity, and it often comes out in this ugly form." But what's really interesting here is that several states have decided that this is a moral and legal issue of state concern. Legislators in Missouri, for instance, are considering banning mixed martial arts competitions, especially cage fighting, for children age 12 and under. Now, Republican State Representatives Brian Stevenson of Webb City and Steve Hunter of Joplin, Missouri, have introduced the measure. Steven said this. He said, "I think it borders on child abuse. I don't think it's appropriate behavior at all." Now, what makes this, to me, all the more interesting is that for these kids, especially these young kids, to be involved in this, they have to be taken there by parents. In other words, there's somebody signing these kids up for this. There's somebody buying the kid the ticket to do this. There's somebody buying the equipment for the kids to wear when they do this. And I can fully understand, I can tell you, I can fully understand a 9, 10, 11-year-old boy wanting to do this. I cannot understand the parents of a boy that age thinking this would be an appropriate behavior. It just comes back to the fact that we have a parent problem before we have a child problem in America, especially when you're dealing with children this age. Doctors are beginning to warn, and this is really the impetus behind the legislation, that this kind of fighting, especially at very young ages, can lead to musculoskeletal injuries that can have long-term, indeed lifelong, consequences for these children. The homeschool issue, of course, in California has attracted national attention as the California Appellate Court has ruled that there is no constitutional right to homeschooling, putting the whole issue of homeschooling front and center in California. That court, as you know, recently said it would revisit its decision. But the Los Angeles Times, which has given really very good coverage to this issue, comes back with a story today indicating that the outrage over the court's decision has brought together the cultural left and the cultural right. Christian homeschoolers and radical liberal unschoolers. It's really interesting, but I would suggest to you the Los Angeles Times is onto something here. Because what both of these worldview groupings agree upon is that the public schools really do not meet the needs of their children and are not the place where their children are rightly going to be educated. That's the judgment made by both of these groups, and it's interesting that this one decision has brought them together. It's also interesting to me that the Los Angeles Times is beginning to connect the dots on some of these things and to say that the right to homeschool is the right to unschool, and the right to unschool is the right to homeschool. Interesting coalitions developing. We'll be back to talk about the historical perspective and the current meaning of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. 40 years ago today. We'll be right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene.
That was Walter Cronkite, April 1968, 40 years ago today. Just imagine, if you can, what it would have been like to have been in America 40 years ago. First of all, the year 1968 is itself so significant. It was the year that the Democratic Party started to fall apart, especially leading to the convention in Chicago, riots on the streets. It was also the year of tragic assassinations. Of course, on April the 4th, the assassination was that of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. On June the 6th, the assassination of Senator Robert F. Kennedy, immediately after he won the California primary for the Democratic nomination for president. But even as we're setting this up for our understanding today, in order to put it in its historical context, we need to remember what was going on this week before America's attention was turned to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. On Monday, the Monday of this week, President Lyndon Baines Johnson, having lost the New Hampshire primary, made this stunning announcement to a national television audience.
I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
A very interesting, fascinating historical context here. That was, of course, the statement that was made by President Johnson that stunned the nation as he withdrew from the presidential race, his own party's nomination contest. It's hard to imagine right now a sitting United States president, an incumbent president, having to withdraw from the race for his own party's nomination. That's how fractured America was. On the racial issue, on the issue of Vietnam, on socioeconomic, on so many social and cultural and moral issues, America appeared to be coming apart at the seams. One of the symbols of the great divide in America was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And we're going to be talking about his significance then and his significance now. But the reality is that in 1968, on April the 4th, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in an event that has become now iconic in American history, not only because of what was, but what many wonder could have been. My guest today on the program is Dr. Ken Fentress, who is senior pastor of the Montrose Baptist Church in Rockville, Maryland. He holds a PhD from Johns Hopkins University, formerly served as Dean of Intercultural Studies here at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. He's a great scholar, wonderful preacher, and a dear friend. Dr. Fentress, welcome to the Albert Mohler Program.
Thank you, Dr. Mohler. It is a pleasure to be with you today.
You know, one of the things that you and I have talked about for a long time, Ken, is the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Let me ask you, you know, preaching as you have been and will be doing, talking to people in your church and beyond, now 40 years after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., how do you explain to people your estimation of who he was, what he meant, and what his assassination really meant for the nation?
Well, I think one of the ways that I explain to people the wealth and the worth of Dr. King to American history is for us to just look around us today. Even though things may not be perfect in our society, yet this is a society that has come a long way in many ways with regard to race relations, with regard to justice and equality in our society. And in the movements beyond the old era of Jim Crowism. And Martin Luther King Jr. was a central figure in that progress in American life. And he was a central figure in that progress as one who was willing to risk and sacrifice his life to see America make progress in this most important way.
Okay, let's talk about that for just a moment. I want us to juxtapose two sound clips from the life and ministry of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. First, we're going to hear from his speech in Washington, D.C., perhaps his most famous speech, given on August 28, 1963, the March on Freedom. The speech became known as Let Freedom Ring. This is clip 11, guys.
So let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
That is perhaps the speech that launched Martin Luther King Jr. most prominently into the nation's consciousness, the March on Freedom. He gave the address everyone was expecting to be the hallmark address, but it ended with a crescendo that has become something of an anthem for America ever since. This is the same speech in which he said, "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today," he said. That's the first clip. I want you to listen to the second clip. This is the clip of the night before he was assassinated, the last speech he gave, the last sermon he delivered in Memphis, Tennessee.
"We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. My eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord."
Fascinating to look in retrospect at the speeches and sermons given by Martin Luther King Jr., especially the month before he died. He seemed to have a premonition of his violent death. Speaking in the National Cathedral, he spoke of not seeing himself the land of promise, but seeing that his people would one day get there. When we come back, we're going to be talking about what happened between 1963 and 1968. We're going to be talking about what's happened between 1968 and the year 2008. We're going to be looking at Martin Luther King Jr. and his legacy and taking a look at what this means for America today. The phone number is 877-893-8255. To join us, just call 877-893-TALK. I'll be back with this conversation and our guest, Dr. Ken Fentress, in just a moment. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation, and this is one of those issues that demands an intelligent, thoughtful Christian response. Join the conversation by calling us, 877-893-8255. Write us at mail@albertmiller.com or go to albertmiller.com and send us a message directly from the site. We'll be right back with your calls and comments on the Albert Miller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
It's the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. My guest today is Dr. Ken Fentress, senior pastor of the Montrose Baptist Church in Rockville, Maryland. I want to turn to Dr. Fentress. Ken, I want to ask you specifically. I played those two clips, 1963, 1968. Something happened between those 2 years that clearly made Dr. King more pessimistic. What was that?
Well, I think one of the things that happened, well, certainly by 1964, '65, the Vietnam War was beginning to rage, and problems were happening there. That was beginning to seriously trouble Dr. King all the way up to 1968. Also in 1965, the assassination of Malcolm X contributed to the problems and to his concerns. Furthermore, there was escalating violence among many of the black radicals of the 1960s, radical groups such as the Black Panther Party, Stokely Carmichael and others, who were opposing Dr. King's nonviolent approach to dealing with these issues, and they were advocating violence more and more. And furthermore, there was also the issue of poverty. The issue of poverty had begun to weigh significantly on Dr. King's mind.
Now, he obviously had a really deep knowledge. It seemed almost a premonition of his own death. That has to also, most obviously underline the gravity of what he had to say there in that address in Memphis.
Well, yes, that is very true. And, of course, his own death coming in the light of, again, violent acts that had already taken place, such as in the case of 1965, Malcolm X's assassination. I mean, Dr. King and Malcolm X were not on the same page on a number of issues. But given the climate of the times and J. Edgar Hoover's FBI and all of the other intrigues that were going on, Dr. King's concerns were elevated, and the concerns of the people who worked with him were elevated for his safety during those years. You know, one of the things, Dr. Mohler, that's so important for us to recognize about the Let Freedom Ring speech that took place in 1963 is that we're talking about a speech that focused on those one of the most basic of American themes, the theme of freedom, the importance and the significance of freedom. And this speech comes basically on the heels of nearly a century of the Jim Crow era. What's so striking about this is if one steps back and looks, takes a larger view of history, shortly after the Civil War, you'll remember that we had a period of Reconstruction. And for example, in the state of South Carolina, the state legislature in South Carolina during Reconstruction had become predominantly African American. But then there was a reversal at the end of Reconstruction, the federal government pulling its troops out of the South. And what starts is the Jim Crow era, and things get set back even after all that takes place with the Civil War. Things are set back for basically 100 years. By the time we get to the 1960s and the ascendancy of the Civil Rights Movement, that movement gets its emphasis to correct wrongs that had been done for the previous 100 years and beyond. And so Dr. King's speech on freedom has profound significance at a profound moment in history. And when you couple that with the mountaintop speech in 1968, it is quite amazing. But as a prophet, I think he knew that there was very much the possibility that he would have to pay for, he knew that he would have to pay for this with his life.
You know, the amazing thing when you start looking back at it is not that that on April the 4th, this historic tragedy took place in Memphis, but that lacking the security that that Dr. King just didn't have. I mean, he just was not protected the way that a major public figure would be protected. In some ways, it's almost miraculous that it didn't happen earlier. And we need to recall that it was 1958. There was a previous assassination attempt where he was stabbed and nearly died in New York City. And you start looking at this and you realize that America has a more violent past than many of us would like to remember. And not only more violent, but deeply morally conflicted, tragically morally conflicted on an issue like race. We're going to come back to talk with Dr. Ken Fentress. There's an opportunity for you also to join the conversation by calling us at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're also going to be listening a little bit more to what Dr. King had to say to the nation as we figure out what his legacy means, not only then, but now. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and I think sad news for all of our fellow citizens and people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee.
Well, Senator Robert F. Kennedy, who was himself assassinated barely 2 months after he made that announcement in Indianapolis as he was campaigning himself for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1968. It's another reminder to us also of the fact that we live in an era of 24/7 news. It's hard to imagine that there would be anyone who wouldn't know that great historic tragedy by the time that Robert F. Kennedy made those words, but that kind of news was genuinely news, often spreading much more slowly back in 1968. And the dynamic of Robert F. Kennedy making that speech to a largely African-American crowd in Indianapolis was something that you could hear in the response of the great grief of that crowd as the announcement was made. My guest today is Dr. Ken Fentress, pastor of the Montrose Baptist Church in Rockville, Maryland. We've been talking about the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. You know, generally every year this comes up in association with the date of his holiday that has been around since the Reagan administration in the 1980s. But in reality, this 40th anniversary is a reminder to us that we're at least a generation or two past this event, and yet it continues to shape the American mind and the American heart. Dr. Fentress, I want to ask you the hard question, and I think there are a lot of people who'd be listening today who would say, you know, as Christians trying to figure out the life and legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., I can't separate all this from the fact that what's now known about him is that he held to a very liberal theology, a theology that neither you nor I would identify with, a theology that both you and I would say would be deeply concerning and deviant from that of Christian orthodoxy in terms of his own theological perspectives. And yet we would also say that there, it is now known, are grave concerns about his personal morality and lifestyle choices. And yet, I would have to say, Dr. Fentress, that the reality is that when he spoke on race, when he spoke to so many of these issues, but especially on the issue of race, when he articulated what he said on the March on Freedom, the March on Washington, and what he had to say in so many of these other addresses that are now iconic in American history, what he was saying was deeply prophetic, and it is indeed the truth of what he had to say that became such a matter that seared the American conscience. How do you put all this together as yourself, a pastor?
Well, one of the ways that I put this together is that I understand, first and foremost, about the life of Dr. King and the legacy of the man himself, that he lived in a time that called for the kind of ministry and prophetic voice that he had. In other words, it was a time of such great difficulty that here is a man who was driven at any sacrifice, at all costs, to stand up and do what he did. Despite any personal deficiencies and weaknesses that he possessed in his life, he felt compelled to stand up for what was right. And we do thank God for that. We are thankful.
Yes.
That on those things that he was right about, he was right.
Yeah, and he was right. I mean, that's what we need to nail down. He was right. I disagree with some of his analysis on political terms, but on the issue of America's tragic guilty conscience on race, on the matter of America's tragic and immoral segregationist policies and all the rest, on the fact that, racism is indeed a deep sin that indicts personal and cultural conscience. He was absolutely right. I think one of the things Dr. Finch will need to remind people of living today is that violence was so much a part of American culture at this time, and there were those who had argued that indeed Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s message of violence was itself simply not enough. Just to set it in historical context, I want us to hear something that's very difficult. I want us to hear a message from Malcolm X about Martin Luther King Jr.
Just as Uncle Tom, back during slavery, used to keep the Negroes from resisting the Bloodhound or resisting the Ku Klux Klan by teaching them to love their enemy or pray for those who use them despitefully. Today, Martin Luther King is just a 20th century or modern Uncle Tom or a religious Uncle Tom who is doing the same thing today to keep Negroes defenseless in the face of attack that Uncle Tom did on the plantation to keep those Negroes defenseless in the face of the attacks of the Klan in that day.
Now, that's just an historical marker. Let's just remember that a part of the courage of Martin Luther King Jr. was to say to his own people, we will get there, to say, I have a dream, and to articulate that dream in such a clearly prophetic way. And even on the night before he was assassinated, for him to say, I may not get there with you, but I have been to the mountaintop, and I have seen. You know, Dr. Fentress, to me, that helps to put into context why we have an enduring debt to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Well, that's absolutely true, Dr. Moeller. And let me say this also. In another speech, Dr. King made the statement that we don't have to hate as we try to straighten this situation out. And those were words that were directly intended for people like Malcolm X and others who advocated violent response and reaction to the injustices that black people were enduring during that time. It took tremendous courage for Dr. King to stand up for nonviolence. And it's something that I think a lot of our listeners may not be aware of, is that in the African-American context during that era, for one to be conservative, that is, theological conservatism, for one to be conservative, essentially those who were conservative were by and large quiet. That is to say, for many of them, many African Americans during that time, they just simply, those who were of the more conservative mindset, felt that the best way to deal with these things was simply to be quiet and to say nothing at all. And they saw Dr. King as an agitator. One of those personalities was Dr. Joseph Jackson, who was the president of the National Baptist Convention.
Yes.
And so there was a deep rift there. It took a tremendous amount of courage. But Dr. King said, in his own words in some of his writings, that it was actually his encounters with various forms of liberalism that actually motivated him to get out of the mindset of do nothing and be quiet. At least that was his own personal testimony. I don't think this is in any way an affirmation of liberalism or anything like that, but it was part of his own personal testimony as he saw it.
Very well put. That helps to put it into context. And that's what we need. If we're going to think intelligently as Christians about this, we need historical context in order to understand the man and his times. 40 years later, an awful lot of the folks who are hearing this conversation weren't even alive. Some who were alive need to remember it as it really was. We'll be right back.
I'm not talking now about a weak love. It would be nonsense to urge oppressed people to love their oppressors in an affectionate sense. I'm not talking about that. Too many people confuse the meaning of love when they go to criticizing the love ethic. I'm talking about a love that is so strong that it becomes a demanding love. I'm talking about a love that is so strong that it organizes itself into a mass movement and says somehow, I am my brother's keeper. And he's so wrong that I'm willing to suffer and die if necessary to get him right and to see that he's on the wrong way.
That was Martin Luther King Jr., a speech given in Florida entitled Loving the Oppressor. Dr. Ken Fentress has been my guest. Ken, thank you so much for joining us today. As we have to go in these closing moments, I want to ask you, is it appropriate for us to look at the life of Martin Luther King Jr. and say that he did exactly what he said in that message? He said, I am my brother's keeper, and he is so wrong that I am willing to suffer and die if necessary to get him right and see that he's on the wrong way.
Yes, Dr. Moeller, absolutely. In fact, in those words, in that speech, Dr. King encapsulated the, in many ways, the essence of the Christian gospel. That's one of the things that we should note about his words, is that he is talking about the kind of love that is embodied in the scriptures. In fact, embodied in the life, the teachings of Jesus, and in his death, his vicarious death on the cross, his suffering and all that he endured. I think Dr. King and the civil rights movement had a dogged determination to demonstrate love to people who hated them, no matter what the consequences were. And in that, he really did, and in that point in time, the movement really did embody love according to the Christian gospel.
And Dr. Finchel, let's just remind all of us, ourselves and others, as we're having this conversation, that the Christian understanding of race is a severe, the biblical understanding of race is a severe indictment, especially of America during the day of slavery and segregation, during the age of Jim Crow, but also insofar as racism persists in this country, is still a severe indictment, because we as Christians have to start our racial ethic with the understanding that God created us, every single human being made in his image, and that God delights in the diversity of races. And we know that because when we get to the book of Revelation, Revelation chapter 5, when we are pointed to the vision of the redeemed people who are glorifying God throughout eternity, they are identified as men and women from every tongue and tribe and people and nation. To echo the words of Dr. Martin Luther King, when you look to that vision, we all have to say, I have a dream. Let's pray it's a dream that is increasingly fulfilled in this world as we anticipate the world to come. Back with you next week for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mohler Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.